Well, we have about 20 minutes for questions. So our guests should be directed toward the speakers.
Distinguishing those two notions of undesirable, I began with the first notion of undesirable as something that's unwanted, unbeneficial, disadvantageous. And I have no problem with the description, Martin's description, of, for example, a notion of immortality as being undesirable in that sense. And I think Sam was also looking at that very same notion in his analysis of the fact that the chance is also the threat, or that even better, the best is in fact the worst. But I had no problems with that notion of the undesirable. What I was trying to question lightly, and I think what Adrian did a much better job of trying to reveal, is the questionability of that second notion of undesirable. Is it really something, is the notion of God, the immortal, the unscathed community, is that really something that cannot be desired or that is not desired? And I was willing to go along with the argument as long as Martin was willing to accept what I was calling the friendly supplement of a desire that is motivated by what I was calling these structures of phantasm. I think
yeah.
Adrian was moving in a similar direction. So I think it's important. I don't know if I can bring this to back to Dante, but your description there was you were talking about a kind of internal contradiction within the presentation of certain figures within the Paradiso. I would argue that the phantasm is always precisely contradictory, and that it exercises a force because of that, and it cannot simply be drained of that force by trying to demonstrate that it's undesirable in both senses, and particularly in the second one, that it cannot be desired. I don't think that even if Martin's argument is correct, it would drain the phantasm of the effect or the power that it still has over us.
Yeah, and I think what lends further support for that, if you turn to psychoanalysis, is the fact that, you know, Freud insists again and again in various ways, you know, not only in the metapsychology papers there in the 19-teens surrounding that essay on transience that's so important for Martin, especially in the chronolibidinal reading essay, that's, you know, kind of supplementary text to radical atheism, that, of course, you know, the unconscious is perfectly comfortable with and constantly deals with what would otherwise be, at the level of consciousness, contradictions which would result in self-cancellation or would annul each other, but that there's a way in which you can have these Hegelian, you know, dialectical convergences of opposites that the unconscious is, you know, fine with sustaining, and that are part and parcel of what structures, you know, its desiring, the formations of its fantasies, etc.
Well, in the unconscious, if there's no negativity, and if therefore there is no negative finitude, and if therefore there is no death in the unconscious, then the unconscious is stupid. I mean, it desires... desires things it can't desire.
Well, it's funny, in the 23rd seminar, Lacan, one of my favorite one-liners by him is, you know, sometimes the truth is stupid. Now, of course, he says that warning against a kind of knee-jerk hermeneutics of suspicion, where we're always on the lookout for, you know, greater depth and complexity and nuance and whatnot. And occasionally what you're dealing with is something which is just deeply idiotic, and in a way, it's like with, you know, the hiding of the letter in, you know, the purloined letter. It's just right out there on the surface, this dumb, you know, X. And that if we constantly are looking back behind it, second and third and fourth guessing it, that we're actually going to miss what's there to be found. But, yeah.
But Nietzsche posits the desirability of making desire stupid, I mean, in forgetting, right? I mean, there's an act of forgetting. He talks in the Gay Science about the animal that is in heat and doesn't care about anything but just getting that done. He says it's forgetful. He says, like the noble. The noble is that way too. He forgets himself when all he thinks about is the act that may be done. And I wonder if you just think, I mean, the question of God for me is a bit troubling in this entire thing about radical atheism. I sort of think that, I mean, God is defined in so many different ways and so forth. I've never, though I fully support the notion of radical atheism, I have never identified with the term atheism myself. It seems to be a kind of a, to raise a lot of side issues that actually throw you back into the binary of, you know, theism and atheism. And so for that reason, I've always been skeptical of it. But what about if we take just a dumb, stupid desire that you desire, you know, as in Keith in the Ode to the Grecian Urn, lips evermore about to kiss. Right? That moment. You're not thinking that the beloved is mortal. All you're thinking about is you're going to kiss in just one moment. And you're totally stupid. You forget absolutely everything else. And then afterwards you think, as Keats does, he says, oh, I know it's impossible. I know you can't have that moment eternalized because then there's no chance and no threat and so forth. But that's what I would like if it were possible. That's, you know, how cool that would be to eternalize that stupid moment of pure bliss that you've got. Why is that not?
I want to substitute the word unreasonable for stupid.
What?
I want to substitute the word unreasonable for stupid. Now, of course, you could also say the unconscious is both, much less clever, much more clever. Measured.
But this is conscious.
To,
I'm
yes,
talking
yes,
about
yes,
a conscious
yes,
desire.
Right, sure.
Nothing fancy, you know. And I think that this is the level at which when people think, wow, you know, heaven, you know, they're imagining it on the model of something like that, an uninterrupted pleasure. And then you say, but nothing ever happens in heaven. Well, I don't know how it would work, you know. I just want uninterrupted pleasure.
Don't bother me with the details.
Exactly.
Well, to go from like a reference to a Greek urn to, you know, much more lowbrow popular culture reference, there's actually two scenes in The Simpsons, both involving the Simpsons' next door neighbors, the Christian fundamentalist, the Flanders, which are interesting from a radical atheist standpoint. And in one instance, Homer, who has, of course, is typically, you know, an idiot, right, is discovered that one of the things which has been impairing his intelligence is a crayon he jammed up his nose as a child. It's removed, he gains something like 40 or 50 IQ points. And all of a sudden, he's much more clever. And one of the things he does in his spare time is and I imagine this almost kind of like Badiou's use of post-Cantorian set theory to argue that God doesn't exist. You know, he comes up with a one-page, you know, mathematical-style proof for God's non-existence, and he photocopies it, and he leaves it in people's windshields in the neighborhood, and he's leaving it in Flanders, on Flanders' car. Flanders comes out for his Sunday morning drive to church, looks at it, and he reads it, and he goes, oh my goodness, well, there must be an error here. No, wait. And then he just takes out a lighter, burns it, and is like, well, nobody will be seeing this, and off they go to church, right? And there's this way in which that's a challenge, I think, for a certain aspect of Martin's project. But then there's a piece of support. That challenges it. But then there's a piece of support from the Flanders where... at one point, I think Maud Flanders has some, they were concerned that she might have died, and they find out she didn't, and then they say, oh, well, you know, thank you, God, for saving us from eternal bliss, right, which indicates that we fantasize about it, but then when we're actually faced with the prospect, of course, we recoil in horror, because there's that sense that maybe he's right, and that would be the worst rather than the best. Anyhow, sorry.
Yes.
I have a question for Sam. In the issue of language, I mean, mean, I wonder about the sense of whether Martin was leaving language aside, or if through this issue of prescription, or if he's prescribing against prescription in a very knowing way, and that has to do with the sedimented prescriptions that are in, you know, within or inscribed or prescribed within the words deconstruction, the words Derrida, and the words associated with that.
Right.
And that this prescription against prescription is based on a very particular historical situation, which you've analyzed previously in terms of the beasts of deconstruction in previous sort of generations of scholarship. And if his, so he sort of is dealing with the issue of language first in avoiding you know, prescriptive claims for deconstruction, and second through his style, which Adrian, you know, characterized as being the sort of pure logical style, which again in the historical in the historical considerations of deconstruction, what we associate as sedimented with that word deconstruction, it's not always that sort of style of logical systematic analysis. So that language is there, and it's not necessarily excluded, but it's within both what he prescribes against prescription, and second, his sort of style against other forms of deconstruction.
I just started looking for a quote that I...
Because that would be to say, I mean, the quote I was thinking of, so there's a quote in there that is, there is no intrinsic normativity in deconstruction, okay, which is maintaining. And so this would be to say, well, there is normativity in deconstruction, we're making a normative move at this moment, or Martin is making the normative move in this book to try to neutralize some of the other normative moves that have been made in the past. Now, that would be consistent with saying there is no intrinsic normativity, because now we're having a battle over which kind of normativity there is. But I guess, and maybe Martin in his response can clarify this at the end of the day, I guess I take that there is no intrinsic normativity in deconstruction, but kind of mean there is no normativity in deconstruction. I mean, I think that's what he's trying to get at. I mean, I guess I think if you're right, and I think that's probably what is going on. You're getting he's purporting to be value neutral, or reading Derrida as being value neutral to try to neutralize some of the values that have been put in there. But then that's to play the game of value. That's not to say that it is a value neutral practice. That would be to situate it at this historical juncture. But I think that is then, I actually don't think that's what Martin wants to do in terms of describing what deconstruction is. I think it's not just that this, because the point is that it wouldn't, I mean, you could say, well, that's the norm to end all norms. You know, that will be the last norm. We'll make it neutral, and then we'll be on that level playing field. But part of what I want to say is we don't get to do that. We don't get to own language that way. You can try to do that, but you can't control, just like you can't control meaning, you can't control value in your language either. So I think that would be, you couldn't sustain that. There's no the complete stability. But I'd agree with reading it that way. And certainly, I mean, I don't think any of us necessarily talked about this, although it was talked about by Richard in the beginning, but I mean, reading it in terms of the what's happened in deconstructive scholarship, definitely. Yeah.
I think my question is about the first speaker. So I'm very interested in this part. You think that this consciously we acknowledge God's dies, but unconsciously God is still living there. And if we follow the Freud's scheme, we think the manifesto concept and latent concept. And then we can re-paraphrase in another way about a signified and signified. And in the Freudian scheme, we think this unconscious is very important, at least to take the priority over the conscious part. So therefore, in this way, you can see it, the signified has a priority over the signifier in this in your examples. But there seems to be contrary to the Lacan's another claim, that is all signifier over the signified. We have the part there. And in this way, Lacan seems to emphasize that signifiers are very important because we are all constructed by language. Signified does not seem to be very important. So it seems a little bit contradictory. What was your understanding?
Well, here's the thing. On this point at least, I am not a Lacanian who views Lacan's claim to be, you know, the defender of the true Freudian orthodoxy under the banner of his return to Freud to be, you know, entirely accurate. And I think that there are some real points of divergence between them. One of them would be, as I would caution against, you know, the starting presupposition for this line of questioning, namely that you could map the Saussurean distinction between signifier and signified onto the Freudian distinction between conscious and unconscious. I don't think you can do it that way. I would suggest considering Freud's discussions of word presentation and thing presentation at conscious, preconscious, and unconscious levels. And I think as soon as you start looking at that material, you'll see that you don't have one, you know, nice, neat, and clean parallel mapping there at all. And, you know, of course, this has been the basis for, you know, some, you know, you might say the discontents of Lacanianism in a lot of French psychoanalytic and theoretical circles, of course. For instance, Paul Ricoeur, without mentioning Lacan by name in his famous book, you know, on Freud and philosophy, you know, points out how you don't end up being able to just simply project the Saussurean schema, at least in this version, onto Freud's various metapsychological models, at least, you know, up until the changeover to the second topography, and even then it becomes worse and more complicated. So I would just simply say that I don't think I can answer the question based upon the point of departure with it.
Mine was just a minor point following up Paul to Sam, was whether or not your question could, Martin, could be pushed stronger if you qualified language to the French language for Derrida. Whether, I was thinking about that part in monolingualism and some other things that...
Yeah, I don't know if that would be strong. I don't know what by stronger.
It doesn't necessarily be the thing about democracy to come, but dealing with materiality of the French language being the basis and the inheritance
right.
of the French language.
Yeah, so one could look at it in terms of what's going on in the French language, but then it's also to try to say that the Derrida in English is Derrida as well. I mean, so it's not that. So one can't limit it to Derrida in French, especially because he often writes with a view to translation anyway. But yeah.
And it still is dealing with the obstacle, right?
Right. Yeah. So that might give you a different. And this is one of the things, you know, I'm reading him in French, but I'm not a native French speaker, so I'm thinking there are things there that, and we were having a discussion last night about translation and Derrida and resonant. I mean, yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, this is one of the things about it. I mean, to make this claim is not to say much, and it's not really to be able to necessarily determine what the values are in there, but that's part of the point. And when Derrida says, well, I'm speaking in an idiom anyway, French, my French is an idiom, that's part of the point, is that it's not going to be under his control, even there.
I think one could displace this relationship between the descriptive and the prescriptive and think about the relationship between the constitutive and the performative, mm-hmm. which brings another dimension of language in. Because when it comes to places where one expects a prescriptive, one oftentimes gets a performative, an I hope, an mm-hmm. I affirm, a j'accepte. He does not cast prescriptions in the constitutive form. This is what needs to be done. You cast them on a performative level. And I think that's an important addition.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, actually, when the first draft of this paper, I was using description, prescription, because that's the language of sort of part of Martin's discourse, but I don't think that is satisfactory. I tried to pull all of those terms out and start substitute. I was talking about normativity originally when I was thinking about this, but I actually think value is better because normativity is a much broader term. And I think prescription is just too, I mean, Derrida doesn't prescribe. I mean, it's too far at one extreme, and I think there's stuff that's going in much closer that's happening that prescription just doesn't capture. So to say he's not prescriptive is not to say much, I don't think, yet.
We still have time for another question.
Yeah, I had a question for Adrian about, you mentioned that the Martin in his reading of atheism, that it might be, you know, too reasonable or too rational, and that psychoanalysis suggests a different logic, but you also said that it suggests a different temporality. I feel like
yes.
I have a handle, maybe not a great handle, but you know, something of a handle on the logic through, you know, Keats and The Simpsons. But but I'm wondering about the temporality, because he said that for Martin, the soul, the form of temporality is ultimately like going back to this Greek temporality, the model of
yeah.
you know, the instant that
yeah.
I mean, that Derrida traces from, you know, Aristotle up
yes.
through I guess, you know, Heidegger's critique of the vulgar form of a temporality. But I wondered, could you say a little bit more, I guess, about the psychoanalytic model of temporality, maybe specifically
yes.
around this problem of the instant? That I mean, where would be
yeah,
I mean, something other than what's presented in deconstruction.
Okay, well, there would be, you know, two basic aspects that I have in mind here in terms of psychoanalytic conceptualizations of temporality that would be relevant. One component can be found most famously, you know, in Freud's 1894 studies on hysteria, the, you know, famous notion of Nachträglichkeit, of deferred action. And then later in the metapsychology papers, which again, it's important to keep in mind that on transience and a few of the pieces of Freud most important for Martin are surrounded by, in the years both before and after, the elaboration of the metapsychology, which involves such claims as the unconscious does not know anything about the logical function of negation, and moreover, it also doesn't really have any understanding of and pays no attention to time, at least in terms of linear time. Now, Derrida, for instance, in the Mystic Writing Pad piece from Writing and Difference, is careful to point out that it's clear that Freud just takes for granted that time there is coextensive with linear chronological time, and that if the unconscious is zeitlos, is you know, atemporal or timeless, that it's only timeless relative to, measured against, that, you know, very simple, straightforward sense of time as linear chronology. But of course, what Freud has been talking about is that, you know, the unconscious is happy to, in a way, creatively cut and paste and juxtapose things in a way that pays no heed whatsoever and doesn't respect at all the kind of, you know, linear ordering that we are used to in terms of laying out, for instance, our memories, you know, or other pieces of mental content as well at a more abstract level too. And so there's that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, there's the fact too that, of course, you know, it's not, you know, there's a way in which this reordering process is also being driven by a kind of, you know, continual après-coup effect, a sort of, you know, retroactive revising. You know, Freud already in Letter 52 to Fleece gets at this too when he talks about the dynamic of retranscription, you know, but then this, of course, gets picked up and worked with by him later, and then Lacan makes it, you know, very central to his account. And I felt as though, I don't think the latter is as much of a problem for Hagelin's work, but I think the former does pose some challenges, because when Freud says that the unconscious is ignorant of negation and of time, Freud then concludes that the unconscious is also constitutively ignorant of death, that finitude is being linked to mortality is not something, and maybe you can think of finitude in other ways, but a finitude that would specifically have to do with mortality, which I think often, Martin, I do think you switch back and forth between finitude and mortality in a way where there's maybe not a strict equivalence, but a close tethering of those terms, that Freud would have a problem with that, right? And talks about how the unconscious cannot come to grips with, and then Lacan later famously says, birth and death are the two things which have no solution in the signifier, and he says this in the third seminar. It's these aspects of Freud and Lacan, among others, you know, that I point to and I say, I think that this poses a challenge, because if desire is in part structured by unconscious fantasies, and unconscious fantasies, although they can't, I think Martin's right, they can't come up with a conception of, you know, eternal timeless stasis, but they also, at the same time, on the other side, I don't think are able to cognize, to come to grips with, to represent what would be involved in infinite finitude, and I think that's a real problem. So that's really what I have in mind.
It's practically 12:30.
Okay.
So I keep joining our speakers.